We're talking about the path to unretirement for older Americans in this time of worker constraints and positions left unfilled. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. The Hiring Lab at Indeed, they analyzed federal labor data in April, finding unretirements continue to rise as more workers return to work in this tight labor market. But then a column in the New York Times a month ago said, actually, these unretirement headlines are overblown. There's less unretirement going on than the attention to it would suggest. Join in on your experience, nevertheless, 800-642-1234. Jeff Sanzenbacher is an associate professor at Boston College, a research fellow for the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much. It's so nice to be back.
Well, goodness, which way is it? Is unretirement remarkable or unremarkable, you know, in the data you're looking at in pandemic times?
Yeah, this is a great question. I spent some time with my computer and the data last night.
Thank you for that. No problem.
And what I found was, you know, during, you know, prior to the pandemic, if you kind of followed people from 1 month and saw people who said, look, I'm retired, and then looked at them exactly 1 year later in that same month, about 4 to 4.5% of people would say, I'm now working. During the kind of bottom, during the pandemic, that number had fallen all the way to 2.5%. So it fell by about 40%. This is the number that Indeed is using. So I'm using their method here. If you look today, that number is more around 4 or 4.5% again. So I would say there's been a really big increase, but the numbers are basically what they were before the pandemic. So sort of not anything out of the ordinary for what then was a tight labor market. And now is a really tight labor market. So I think that in some ways, like I'll take the typical economist way out and say it's kind of both ways. There's been a really big increase from during the pandemic, but it's not unprecedented relative to what it was before. So I think probably closer to what the New York Times is saying there.
Yeah, they kind of said that, look, you know, to make up for all the people who retired prematurely during the pandemic, the rate of retirees returning to work would have to go significantly higher than it was before the pandemic and stay that way for a while.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, we did some work for the Retirement Research Center at BC. And, you know, we predicted that if the labor market remained really tight for a pretty long time, that you could have a non-trivial amount of workers unretiring, and it could kind of help the labor market. But at the same time, yeah, it has to be for a longer period of time than we're seeing now, and certainly above just kind of what was normal before the pandemic. So, yeah, I kind of agree with that.
Explain why we should be interested in watching this type of unretirement data or retirement data.
Yeah, I mean, I think at a time when you have probably too few workers, and that is certainly helping to drive prices up in some ways, and certainly also making people frustrated at places like airports and restaurants and things like that. And it's hard on employers. Like you need workers who maybe typically aren't there to come back. I mean, you need extra workers from somewhere. And one big pool of extra workers are workers who would normally stay retired, but instead decide to unretire. And so just having a typical number of workers doing that really isn't good enough to make any dent in this problem that we're facing as a country right now. And really a problem that isn't showing any signs of abating. Just, you know, job opening rates are still very, very high. And so I think you have this big pool of workers who could work. And if they just decided to come back, then that would probably be helpful to labor markets.
We don't really know why they're coming back. You know, is it out of necessity, or is it that it's just a very favorable labor market for them?
Yeah, most of the research, you know, and all of this is kind of qualified by it was before the pandemic, but most of the research suggests that people who unretire a lot of times do it because they always sort of planned on retiring. They were a little bit burnt out at their job. And so they, you know, took a break, and then they decided to come back. And it was something they maybe always planned on doing. And a lot of times I think it's to an old employer, an employer that they maybe enjoyed working for, and maybe they come back in a role with a little less responsibility, a little more flexibility, that kind of thing. Mm. And I think that during really tight labor markets, that's just easier to do. And employers may even be reaching out to the employees saying, hey, you know, you used to work, you know, you worked here before, we really liked you, could you come back? And so I think during tight labor markets, that transition gets easier. Right now, because levels are very similar to what they were before the pandemic, I don't get the sense that it's really being drawn back by inflation or being drawn back by the stock market being down. It seems to me right now it's for kind of normal reasons. Whether in the future that changes is obviously unclear.
We're talking about the number of retirees who are returning to the workforce and why this matters. Why watch it? Jeff Sanzenbacher, research fellow for the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, our guide. You can join in with your story. Have you come out of retirement recently? Tell us what happened, why, what your situation is. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff, I wonder if there's anything to this, that ageism is less of an issue in a tight labor market, that the type of discrimination, you know, that it becomes a less powerful force. The unretired aren't picked over or even forced out for those prized younger workers and older Americans, maybe at a moment where they can land jobs that are more meaningful or more in line of what they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly anytime there's a really, you know, in the last two decades, anytime there's been a really tight labor market, you do see people unretiring more. And certainly that suggests that there is this element of ease to it. I mean, if employers want you and need you and maybe are willing to let go of any prejudice they might have against older workers, if that's happening, then yeah, I absolutely think that really tight labor market, you know, can only help.
What about the high inflation? I mean, we're at record high inflation. There have been some, heart stoppage in the stock market as well, some drops. Does that influence whether someone changes their mind about going back into the workforce?
Yeah, the inflation part's, I think, important to note. And for a lot of people, I'm a big supporter of Social Security. And one of the reasons I am is that it's inflation protected. So every January, people get a cost of living boost. And usually that's enough. Right now, with inflation as high as it is, you know, being halfway through the year from January, I think inflation probably is starting to erode people's purchasing power, even given their inflation adjusted Social Security benefit. So I do expect that as the year goes on and as we get further and further away from that last COLA adjustment, that you could see people on the margin being encouraged maybe to come back to work by those rising prices. On the stock market front, I would think that takes a little longer maybe to hit home, just because people who have a lot of resources in 401ks probably are the best equipped to weather temporary downturns in the
mm-hmm,
market.
So mm-hmm. They're more sheltered.
Yeah, they're a little more sheltered. So if this holds on for a long time, then you could maybe see that pressure start to exert itself. But in the past, anyway, we haven't really seen stock market downturns really draw people back in very quickly. So I'm keeping my eye more on inflation and more on workers who are very reliant on Social Security, on that population a little bit more.
Talking about retirees returning to the workforce with Boston College retirement research economist Jeff Sanzenbacher. Join in on the decisions you made about leaving the workforce maybe before or after age 62, 65, 70. What about unretirement? Has it crossed your mind or have you just started a new job coming back out of retirement? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on The Morning Show with Jeff Sanzenbacher here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. Let's get back to our conversation about unretirement. Economists, they've been talking about that more retirees could return if COVID recedes, if we see these high inflationary levels. Join in on the decisions you have made about retirement, whether you stuck with it, what emotions you felt, or if you found an encore career. 800-642-1234. We have Boston College Associate Professor of Practice, Jeff Sanzenbacher, studies retirement with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Jeff, let's talk Social Security. How does returning to the workforce affect someone's Social Security benefits?
Yeah, you know, it, It does. If you retired and claimed Social Security before your full retirement age, which is between 66 and 67 for people retiring today, then every $2 you make over $20,000 a year, your monthly benefit gets reduced by $1. And that sounds bad, and it sounds like it would discourage people from working, and it does. There's evidence that people who have claimed Social Security kind of are hesitant to come back to work, and I think that's one of the factors. But it is really, really important to note that you get that money back. So basically, they reduce your benefits when you're under your full retirement age. But the second you hit it, you know, you get a boost in your benefits. And that boost is designed so that, as you know, if you lived your early 80s, which is the life expectancy for most people in that age range, then you get actually your benefit, all that money back. And if you live longer than that, you get more than that money back. And so, you know, working and coming back into the workforce can really be a way to, save, where you're reducing your benefit now and getting it later. It's essentially a way to save for later in your life. And so I think that's important to note. And if you're above the full retirement age, then there is no issue. So if you're above your birth cohort's full retirement age, you can earn, and it doesn't reduce your Social Security benefit, which is really nice. So kind of either way, if you're under your FRA, it can help you save, FRA full retirement age, it can help you save for the future in a way. If you're over it, then you can just earn, and it doesn't matter.
So if you're under your full retirement age, and let's say you work an additional side job, you make right just slightly under that $20,000 threshold, yep, would that essentially help you on perhaps living expenses and give you a little bit more to live on if you are paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah, prior to that point, you get to keep your full benefit, and you you could just have some earnings. Yep, exactly.
What is your advice for retirees who might want to go back to work? What should they keep in mind?
I mean, I think it's really important that you're making this choice, and to get that choice right, to make sure that you're coming back to a job that has whatever flexibility you may need. If you have grandkids, if you're taking care of a spouse, that has, you know, the kind of what you want out of a job, that has social component you want, that has obviously the pay you want. You know, it's a chance to pick a job you want. And we see in the research that people who switch jobs voluntarily late in their career, and this would include kind of on retirement, that those people really are able to work longer than other people, because they're able to select the job that really works for them. And so if you're coming back and you're not doing it forced, you're making a choice to come back in, you have employers reaching out to you, or maybe you know the job market's good, that I think it's important to set up a job that you know that's going to work for you, and it's going to let you do that job maybe a little bit longer than you might if you pick a job you don't like. And I think remote work's made that easier. You know, the potential for remote work has certainly made that easier. And so I'm asking about those things and thinking about those things as things to negotiate for, not just pay, but also other aspects of the job, I think is always a good idea.
Thinking also about consulting or contract work where, it's not long term, and yet you can perhaps, after a project is finished, reassess where you're at, whether you want to go for that next contract.
Yeah, I mean, we actually, when you look at the data, a lot of people who unretire are in that cohort who might do that kind of work, kind of, you know, who maybe have done more professional job and are now looking for something a little more flexible. So I do think consulting, that kind of work, is a good option for people and has exactly that kind of flexibility.
What if you worked in the trades or in manufacturing or heavy industry, and that is where your skill set is, but your body isn't able to go back to that type of work? What should you think about then?
Yeah, I think that's a much tougher one. Certainly, we are seeing, so I was looking at the data, like I said, last night, and one of the things I noticed is there's not been a huge trend, but more people who are retiring are doing it into those kinds of jobs, into manufacturing, construction. So it may be the case that those workers are able to find something that maybe suits them better. There are certainly less physical jobs within those industries that might use more of the person's expertise they developed over time. So looking for those kinds of roles might be good. And certainly that might be a good option. But I do think that is a little tougher when physical constraints come in.
We're talking about retirees who have decided to go back to work. Jeff Sanzenbacher, research fellow for the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. You can join in with what you're thinking about in retirement. Maybe retirement is approaching and you are having these emotional things you're thinking through. Join in where you're at, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jeff, if the tight job market continues, do you expect even more retirees will return to work? What are the prospects when you look, you know, 6 months, a year down the road?
Yeah, I mean, we have the, with what the Federal Reserve is doing to try to tamp inflation, I mean, there's always the possibility that the labor market becomes a little more slack or there's fewer job openings. But if this continues, I would absolutely expect that we see those numbers maybe go above pre-pandemic levels. Maybe even 15-20% above where they were before. I don't think that's going to entirely solve the labor shortage we have, but certainly I think it's a good thing for those workers. I think I said last time when I was on that, you know, all the evidence in the world points to the fact that working longer is not just good for your finances, but also just good for, you know, physical health a lot of the time, certainly for mental health. And so, you know, I'm kind of keeping an eye on that and seeing if we can get more people into the labor market. And I expect it to happen based on research I've seen, if we stay here for a while.
I was looking at just that. Someone was saying how just being social and doing something with your time, challenging yourself, challenging your brain. And it does start to make me wonder about whether this is more about the mental and social, emotional side versus the financial influences that could be drawing people back in.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think that is likely to be true. Like I said, I mean, most people who do unretire, they seem to have always thought they might unretire. And so that suggests to me there's this urge to kind of come back and work. And that probably does have a big social component. And I think, yeah, when the labor market's tight, that's just easier to do. And mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have an employer reaching out to you saying, hey, you know, remember a couple of years ago you worked for us, we really liked you, and could you come back? That's a lot easier than when the labor market's not so good and no one's, you know, you're reaching out to them. And so mm-hmm. I really do think it's for those kind of social reasons that people do it. And I think we might see that happening more if it remains easy to come back.
Well, besides unretirement, what else is the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College really looking at and studying with older Americans?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of our more recent work, has focused, you know, on inequality and issues around retirement. I think, you know, I was just reading a paper that the center put out the other day about some of the longer term impacts of things like early childhood adverse events. So, you know, when you're younger, there's physical abuse or neglect, how that affects, you know, your savings over your lifetime and how it affects, you know, your health later in life. And so really, I think thinking about some of those issues around opportunity to have a good retirement and some of the things that might impact someone very early in their life that really affects, you know, their entire life and ultimately manifest themselves in, you know, difficulty retiring well. And I think that kind of like long-term view is something we're trying to shift a little bit more towards, and trying to recognize that this thing that happens at the end of life that we tend to think of as a bunch of adult decisions that maybe, you know, to save and to work and all these things that manifest themselves late in life, that those things are impacted by things that happen in childhood. Mm. And thinking about, you know, what that means for policy and for the importance of programs like Social Security that serve as insurance for those people. So that's something we've been thinking about a little more than we have in the past. And some of that's just because the data are now becoming available to look at it.
One other thing I want to run by you, we only have about less than a minute left, but we've seen lots of headlines about unions, you know, workers within Starbucks, workers in Amazon trying to unionize. Do you see a resurgence there, and what impact might that have on especially on older Americans?
Yeah, believe it or not, I was looking at this yesterday. I just love the data. And I was, you know, noticing that union votes are also up to pre-pandemic levels and kind of continue to climb. And I think some of the same things that lead to unretirement are showing themselves there too. You know, if the labor market is slack and a union shows up and says, hey, we, you know, do you want to join a union? You're going to be pretty wary because you're going to be afraid that, you might be replaceable, I think, or that, you know, it's, and I think when you have this very tight labor market, that workers do feel empowered. And I think you're finally starting to see that play out with all, with, you know, workers like people at Starbucks who typically haven't tried to unionize. I think seeing that is because they feel some power in the labor market right now. And one of the biggest concerns I have about, you know, trying to slow down inflation, which is obviously important, is that those are typically the workers that hurt. And I do wonder if they're going to lose that power in the in the near future. And so I think we're starting to see it, but whether it lasts or not is maybe a different question.
Jeff, always good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I love talking to you in the morning. So,
Jeff Sanzenbacher, Associate Professor at Boston College and a research fellow for the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Ahead this hour, we look at how supply chains are playing out at the port of Duluth Superior. Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about caring for ones we love.
Many of us reach a point in life when it's our turn to take care of our parents. That was the case for Hedy Lamarr Rudd, whose father, Lavelle, had an enormous impact on her life and left a lasting impression on everyone who knew him. She shares their story at the UW Continuing Studies Writers Institute.
All over his body. His hips were replaced and he still tried to straddle a motorcycle. The source of his fragility and his strength was a diagnosis of lupus that he received when he was released from prison around 1978. I remember his being angry at first because he didn't know what was wrong. His fingers hurt, he said. I remember him saying, "How does a black man go to the doctor and cry that his fingers hurt?" Eventually, his already dark fingers turned black with gangrene, resulting in the amputation of most of them. A musician, a writer, a mechanic, a lover, my father found ways to use those nuts to accomplish his goals, but he was never the same. Fingers gone, hips replaced, knees next, and then the glorious day when he received a halo, a contraption that surrounded his chest with bars up to and surrounding his skull to keep his neck and spine from moving. One day, he grew very sick, slipping into a coma. He was brought to Mariner Hospital rather than University Hospital, which is where he was normally treated. A few hours later, the phone rang. "Miss Rudd, this is Mariner Hospital. Your father has checked himself out." "Excuse me," I said. "He was just in a coma. How could he check himself out?" The doctor went on to explain that he had awakened shortly after we left and demanded to be released. They told him that he was in no position to be released and explained why he had been admitted. So as soon as he was left alone, he unplugged his IV tubes, put on a multicolored robe, hospital slippers, and walked out of the hospital. We followed his elusive trail on foot and by car, looking everywhere. While it should have been easy to find an elderly black man wearing a Moses robe, it was more difficult than we expected. We returned home to wait for a call from the police, who we hoped would have better luck than we did. When the call came, we rushed to the hospital, and there sat my dad in a wheelchair with a mischievous grin on his face. The officers explained that they had found him at the Citgo gas station in East Washington. We later found out the little devil had a brain aneurysm, which is how he found himself wearing the halo. Over 100 hip dislocations later, the doctors at University Hospital accused him of purposely dislocating his hip in order to obtain prescription drugs. My dad responded that he could buy much better drugs on the street. To which they chalked him up as a drug addict and began to treat him as such. One resident orthopedic doctor decided that rather than continue to put his hip in place again after being admitted twice in a 24-hour period for separate dislocations, he would put the hip back in and then place a plaster cast around my father's torso. The episode crushed his spirit. A few months later, he was back in the hospital. When I went to visit him, he said, "I shouldn't have woken up this morning. I don't think I will tomorrow." I remember once telling him that I never wanted him to die, and he said he would let me know when he was going to die. I told him that's not how it worked, and in that moment, I told him, "I'll be back to see you the next day." The call came at 3 a.m. that he was finally free. He had kept his promise to me and let me know that it was his time. So after the funeral, we cremated my father. I thought about my father's gifts to the world, his writing, his music, and the memories that others carried of him inside of their hearts. I didn't know if he was in heaven or hell, but I knew that what he left behind was as important as what we lost when he left. And I promised myself that I would live that kind of life, and that when I leave the planet, people will know that I was here. The last promise to keep is mine.
Hedy Lamarr-Rudd's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project, where low-income adults find their voices and earn college credit in an English literature course. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
And now we focus on a shipping hub that is doing container shipping. We look at operations at the port of Duluth Superior on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Bloomberg reported earlier this month that supply chain headaches aren't going away soon. There's still congestion at major U.S. ports. And international trade is again suffering more from the congestion and delays in container shipping. What does that mean for the Twin Ports? Join in 800-642-1234. Deb DeLuca is Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Deb, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate, and thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Sure. Let's start with the new shipping containers activity. The Duluth Superior Port recently expanded services for waterborne cargo containers. What does that mean for Twin Ports activity?
Well, ultimately, it means more flexibility, more options for supply chain solutions through our multimodal logistics hub here at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. And that multimodal logistics hub is also known as the Kluwer Public Marine Terminal.
And what happens at the terminal? Can you give us kind of a picture in our mind's eye?
Absolutely. To us, it is a maritime facility, or it was initially built as a maritime facility, but we serve all the various freight modes of transportation. We have road, rail. We have 430,000 square feet of warehouse space, and of course the deep sea shipping berths that connect us to the Atlantic Ocean via the St. Lawrence Seaway, mm-hmm. the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway shipping system.
What is in these shipping containers?
Well, the shipping containers can contain a wide variety of raw materials, finished goods, consumer goods, foodstuffs. That's the beauty of shipping containers is that they can contain and move almost any cargo variety you can think of.
Super versatile.
Absolutely, and they can move seamlessly between road, rail, and water.
Well, I'm wondering, with bringing shipping container activity to the port, to the Twin Ports, are these new customers, Deb, or are they new to your port, or are they just moving freight in another new way that you're offering?
I should probably back up and explain that this is we're just establishing the service, but you really just nailed it. We're mostly Well, it does two things. It provides opportunities to additional shippers that perhaps haven't used our terminal before, but it also just provides greater optionality for customers that already use our terminal.
What is your assessment then on the global bottlenecks around the supply chain, what you're seeing out there with ships and shipping containers as you look globally? What's going on?
Oh, there's so many factors, Kate. It's everything you've read about. There's a shortage of containers availability, something like 90% of the world's containers are fabricated in China. So there's shortage of containers. There's at the large coastal ports, there's just big backups of containers because they're for all sorts of reasons, whether it's lack of workforce to move those containers off the terminals or whether it's just lack of space to store the containers. There's so many factors. It's difficult to find vessels that are available to make certain service runs. As I said, it's a multifactorial problem.
Are you, you say average roughly 800 vessels in and out of the Twin Ports a year. Will these supply chain issues affect how many vessels you handle at your port?
Could ultimately. We could see more ships that are carrying containers come into the port, and that's true for all of the Great Lakes ports that would ultimately carry containers. But in the short term, for instance, this shipping season, we won't see a big increase.
Mm-hmm. I was reading about Cleveland, the other Great Lakes port that handles shipping containers, and they were saying how Cleveland has been importing shipping containers for 8 years. So kind of a good case study, if you will, but only uses about 6% of its capacity. And meanwhile, we see container ships, as you just mentioned, on the West and East Coast, they're sitting for days on end, in lines to be unloaded, bottlenecks in other areas. Why can't the Great Lakes ports fill these gaps?
Well, it's a great question. First of all, we'll never be able to receive the huge shipping, the huge ships, the Panamax vessels that carry thousands of containers at a time, or tens of thousands of containers at a time. We just don't have the depth to accommodate those ships in the seaway. However, our role really is to serve as a pressure relief valve for those coastal ports. And to get goods into the middle of the continent. We are the furthest inland seaport in the nation. We're 2,342 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, and it would allow containers to come all the way into Mid-America's heartland, where they could be distributed to major distribution centers. However, to get to that point, we face several challenges that we have to be very realistic about. And one is the seasonality of the system. It's closed for part of the year, mm-hmm. due to our winter climate, of course. But in addition, it takes a while to bend supply chains. And to date, we need to establish, so the fact that we have this container capability at both Cleveland and Duluth, it takes a while. We need to establish regular services that bring those containers to those terminals. Now that can happen through one of two ways. We can either have direct service where, for instance, a steamship line would traverse all the way from, a European port like Antwerp or Rotterdam, and come all the way into the system and come right to our terminal. And the alternative is that those smaller ships, the large steamship lines, the big Panamax vessels could travel all the way to, say, Montreal or Halifax, and then transfer the containers to the smaller ships to come into Duluth, Cleveland, and other, we are also working with other ports on the Great Lakes. There are other ports on the Great Lakes that are looking to establish the terminals as well. And that's critical because that would provide the volume of containers that would really support that regular service.
Deb DeLuca leads the Duluth Seaway Port Authority as we check in on cargo volumes, the ongoing global supply chain issues. Join in on questions about how ports operate, your experiences working in freight shipping, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more conversation with Deb DeLuca here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's pick up our conversation with Duluth Seaway Port Authority Executive Director Deb DeLuca. Port tonnage rebounded last year from 2020 pandemic lows. Iron ore, the port's leading cargo by tonnage, we'll talk about that. And now container shipping, opening up new markets. In January, we talked with Port Milwaukee Director Adam Tindall-Schlicht about tonnage ups and downs.
Trade is cyclical. We're seeing a tremendous bounce back in a lot of commercial performance for Great Lakes ports and Wisconsin's ports that struggled last year.
Still time for your questions on Twin Ports shipping, 800-642-1234. Deb DeLuca with us for nine more minutes. Deb, let's talk about, workers. There's been a shortage of workers out there hitting so many industries. Is that affecting the Duluth Superior Port?
That varies depending on the terminal that you could ask about. There's 21 terminals in the Port of Duluth Superior, and they're distributed between the Wisconsin side and the Minnesota side. Here at our, in general, we have been very fortunate to have the labor force, so that the Port of Duluth Superior has risen to the challenge throughout the COVID pandemic and throughout the global supply chain disruptions. So we're really grateful for our team and our partners, you hear about other ports not having the workforce, especially in the truck driver area. And I have to say that although that challenge is out there, our local carriers have been able to meet that challenge, and we have really never failed to get deliveries onto and off of our terminal.
Well, with the cyclical nature, as we just heard there in the cut, I would imagine that sometimes you got to ramp up and then you got to ramp back down. It's not like you have this even keel predictability, because I would imagine there are certainly market shifts that influence what needs will need to be met at the port.
That's absolutely true. This is like an ecosystem here. However, when you think about logistics employers, because there's, you have the trucking industry as well as our terminals, each have their own workforce, and they often hire off of the, through the unions. So there is some flexibility available there. And interestingly, the trucking industry, just like all of the rest of the industries, are facing that need to provide greater worker flexibility. So they are also, there is that opportunity to flex. They have that ability, or they're looking for that ability to flex their workers as well.
Let's talk about iron ore, which you saw, a leading cargo tonnage at your port, huge upswing last year in your data, iron ore being the source for iron and steel industries. What do you make of that surge?
Well, first of all, we're absolutely critical to the steel making supply chain here at the Port of Duluth Superior and all of the Minnesota ports. I do want to put a plug in for 80% of the iron ore that goes into the nation's first port of steelmaking comes out of Minnesota and travels through the Minnesota ports to get to the steelmaking facilities on the Lower Lake. So that's why iron ore is king cargo through our port. That ability to, there was definitely a dampening of demand in 2020. I have to stop and think about which was the COVID
year. What year are you in? Yes.
Yeah, 2020. and we rebounded, all of the production facilities were working at full speed on the iron range here last year. And so that we were able, and of course the supply chain, which was never broken, the steelmaking supply chain was not broken throughout COVID, and that was able to rebound successfully.
Well, and we've also seen, iron ore hit a record high price. Demand surged, as you mentioned, in the pandemic recovery. Now it's come back down. Do you expect that, as we see inventory levels globally stabilizing, prices stabilizing, that shipments will come in line with previous years? Or will you continue to see more and more shipments of iron ore through your port?
We're expecting it to stabilize. And in fact, we've had a relatively slow start to this season. And we're expecting that improved throughout May. We haven't seen our June numbers yet. But that's partly driven by the supply chain issues affecting the automobile makers, you know, the lack of chips, for instance, and appliance manufacturing. But, you know, I was just talking to one of the main producers last week, and they're having an excellent year on the production end. So we should expect to see continued, we're expecting at the end of the year, we're hoping to see, pretty much standard 5-year average type of tonnage through iron ore tonnage through our port.
Talking with Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, Deb DeLuca, with us. Join in on your questions about the Twin Ports, 800-642-1234. So, Deb, on the opposite end, you saw a steep drop in grain and in your 2020 report. And now with the war in Ukraine, that too is such a cause for concern as Russia tries to vie for the control of grain routes and accessing Ukraine's stockpiled grain has become really this urgent international shipping issue. Is there anything Midwest Grain can do in this moment through your port?
Well, it does appear that it would be an opportunity for increased shipments through the Port of Duluth Superior for all the reasons that you meant. There's a diminished global grain supply with Ukraine and Russia essentially taken out of the picture. But exactly what will happen, what will move to this port, depends on many other issues, such as, we know that the 2021 crop was drought hampered. And then prices depend on, if there's a strong dollar, very high wheat prices, there's been delayed planting in 2022 due to the cold, wet spring. All of those will factor into what ultimately moves through through our port.
I just want to land here on climate change, which has such an impact on so many coastal communities. I know you have the icebreakers out early in the winter thaw to head into spring. What has been the impact on your port system with climate change?
Well, there's a couple ways we can look at it. One is, will there be opportunities in the future with a lengthening shipping season? And that's something that the whole industry is kind of looking ahead to and trying to determine how that will affect opportunities through the system. And also, what kind of additional ice breaking assets will we need to support that? And then on the other end of the spectrum is looking at the infrastructure, because as you can imagine, moving all the all the freight movements through the port, whether it's road, rail, or of course the water, requires infrastructure. And that climate, the increased frequency and intensity of storms that we've seen over the past few years really takes a toll on that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So we are constantly expanding, maintaining, improving our infrastructure, we are building that in a way that can withstand those intense storms.
Deb, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm a huge Wisconsin Public Radio fan, so that was a nice opportunity.
Deb DeLuca, Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.